everybody. This is Colleen Johnson with the Agile Uprising podcast, and we're coming to you live from Mile High Agile in Denver, Colorado. I'm joined today with my co-host, James Gifford.
Hello.
And we are talking with Dan Montgomery. Hi, Dan.
Hi, James. Hi, Colleen. Great to be here.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you here. This is a cool topic for our podcast and for our listeners. Dan is the author of the book Start Less, Finish More, and the CEO and founder of Agile Strategies. Can you tell us a little bit about Agile Strategies and what you do with your clients?
Well, some people might think Agile Strategy is an oxymoron. I've been doing strategic planning after an earlier career in IT for about 20 years now. And I got to the point where the models that I was working with, I realized we're not working with people. And it really came to a head for me probably 6 years ago. I was teaching a course in Balanced Scorecard, which is a method of measuring your strategic goals. I was teaching that in San Jose, and I had a whole room full of people who work for tech companies who said, well, you know, Dan, this is intellectually interesting, but there's no way I could take this back to, name a firm, you know, eBay, Microsoft, bunch of those kinds of companies there, because it's not agile enough. And I started looking into what was going on with agile and what that was about. And from my IT career, I recognized like that was actually addressing some problems that we had when I worked on a lot of big projects, you know, mainly back in the 90s, where, you know, we would, analyze the heck out of an entire situation and never actually get the system built because it got into too much detail and it got too expensive. So I was on a couple of notable failed projects where I literally put, in one case, 3 years of my career into it and it never got built. So I thought, well, how do we actually apply this to strategy? And at the time, I knew, living in Boulder, I knew a number of people who worked at Rally, including one of the founders, Ryan Martins, and went and talked to him and some of his other folks about, well, what if we applied these agile principles to strategy? And they said, well, that's exactly what we're trying to do here. So we compared a lot of notes. So fast forward a couple of years, and I discovered OKRs, or Objectives and Key Results, which is actually the way that a lot of Silicon Valley product companies built their strategy, notably Google. So they started using OKRs when they were 20 people, and they still use them with 70,000 people. So anyway, hesitating a little bit there. Maybe you could throw in a question.
Yeah. So how do you bring Agile into that OKR process? Where do these philosophies come together?
Well, the key thing is, the whole concept of waterfall applies to strategic planning as much as it does to software development. So what we used to do would be we would come up with a plan for the next 5 years and say, these are the metrics that we're going to use. This was Balanced Scorecard. These are the metrics that we're going to use for the next 5 years and the targets that we have. And I think we realized, well, that's just absurd. The longest at an enterprise level you should go out with OKRs is a year. So identify what's the big bottleneck we need to overcome. What's the big opportunity? Like, come up with no more than three objectives with then key results, which are measurable targets for that. And then what we do is drill that down into quarterly targets at the enterprise level and then cascade that down to the team level. So that's a lot of what we do when we go into a company now, is talk through the strategy enough to identify annual OKRs, turn those into quarterly OKRs, and then start working with the individual teams about how they're going to contribute to that.
Yeah, sounds a lot like breaking work items down from an agile perspective, right? So taking those big initiatives, breaking them down into epics and stories that are small and measurable and that you can deliver against, but doing that from a strategic perspective so you can actually make some progress and then be able to pivot quickly if the market or needs change for the organization.
Exactly. And we've borrowed a lot of those terms. Like in the book, I talk about epics. So I have one client, they're a chain of veterinary clinics, and they love the idea of epics. So they define what their epics are and then break it all down. And, you know, they've done an amazing job of using a lot of agile techniques, but using it at the executive level. without a lot of the technical kind of terminology. So that's really my goal, is I think of it as Silicon Valley for the rest of it, rest of us, that we can bring these kinds of agile practices into strategic planning and just the work of executive teams.
What do you find, do you find a challenge when you're bringing some of those practices to non-technical environments? Are there any agile practices or terms that you find that is completely foreign to organizations that are not, you know, not in this space or familiar with agile
I usually
methods?
Take the opposite approach, that I don't bring in agile terms unless they're already very familiar with agile.
Okay.
Because I've had a lot of clients that they have not implemented agile in their software development. So I just don't bring up the terms. So I suppose some specific ones I would not talk about would be things like velocity or burn down or sprints or things like that. I mean, I do introduce the idea of some kind of planning increment, which is really a quarter. That's the period that an OKR goes for, but I wouldn't use a term like planning increment. And we tend to take more of a Kanban approach than a Scrum approach in terms of how we organize workflow.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, was how do you track some of that work? Do you leverage agile methods for tracking OKRs and their completion?
Well, again, the big one that I like to introduce people to is Kanban, because that's why I called the book Start Less, Finish More, because the kind of problems agile addresses with Kanban or with sprints and story points, everybody has the same kind of problem, even if they're not going to use the same kind of terminology. So the idea of making work visible, making it transparent, runs through the whole OKR process.
Well, you know, it's kind of, you know, I love OKRs. I just finished up my metrics talk, and I talk about business outcomes and getting people focused on outcomes and giving people that guiding light of, you know, we as a team need to know why we're doing this,
right?
So that it doesn't become that feature factory. But I work for a company that's more interested in delivering stuff than they are looking at results. So, you know, how do you start that conversation to get companies kind of headed in that direction? So, like, how do we get the foot in the door with the OKR when we're so focused on delivering stuff? Like, I'm going to make this product agile. Okay, great. But like, why? What are the outcomes? Like, what is that benefit for us? Like, how do you start that conversation with leadership?
This is the hardest thing, James, is, you know, I don't want to pretend that it's easy for people, because thinking in terms of results rather than a to-do list or a bunch of features, as you're talking about, is really difficult for a lot of people. And I mean, I think it's like the idea of user stories. Like, hypothetically, user stories are supposed to be about delivering some kind of a unit of value to somebody. You know, as a somebody, I'm able to do X, and this gives me this kind of a benefit. So I talk about that kind of concept, and I tell people right up front, you're probably going to default to coming up with a to-do list when you talk about your key results, but the key results are measurable business outcomes. So what does that mean? It means we've gotten to some kind of a new state or a condition that provides value for somebody else. And so it isn't like, well, we're going to implement this system by the end of the quarter. No, it's going to be that the system, what is the system that we're implementing actually going to enable a user to do? So that's where we focus on key results. That's where I spend most of my time coaching when we're talking about drafting these key results, is saying like, no, that just sounds like something you're going to get done. Why are you doing it? So use the five whys. Keep asking why we're doing that and get to a measurable business result. The problem with this a lot of times is it's really easy to focus on tangible business results, which would be things like, well, we want better share value. We want, more EBITDA, you know, all the financial kinds of measures. People are used to those kinds of results, but the things that really drive those are much less tangible. But the fact is, like, there's a famous study done of the Standard & Poor's 500, and 85% of the stock value of all of those companies is actually based on intangible things, which is, we have systems and processes that we use consistently. We have leadership that people have confidence in. We have brand value. All of those things are intangibles. Accountants have no idea how to measure those kinds of things. And so that's often the challenge with this, is trying to find a way. How do we actually measure customer experience? How do we measure employee engagement and those kinds of things? And luckily, there are a lot of companies out there that have measures like that, you know, like Net Promoter Score, Gallup Q12.
Yeah, James just shared a few of those as well. I think some things around employee happiness and...
Yeah.
We were looking at the direct correlation to, like, we're measuring employee happiness, like team happiness, direct correlation to employee satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
So, your team's health and happiness is a leading indicator for potentially how your employee satisfaction survey is going to come out.
That's great. Well, and what we're finding with a lot of the companies we work with objectives and key results, then they start realizing, like, well, we're actually really terrible at giving each other feedback. We're not very accountable when we say we're going to do something. And so we're getting more and more into those kinds of coaching conversations of, like, well, what is your process for making and managing commitments? Because a lot of organizations are what one friend of mine calls, they're slippery about the way they do it. They're a slippage organization. And so if I say, James, I'm going to give you this report by Tuesday, and I don't do it.
I should expect it the following Friday.
Right. Or if at all. Right. But, you know, we don't have a protocol where it's okay for you to say, Dan, where's that report? So there needs to be a way to have a healthy complaint. And then if I recognize I said I'd do it Tuesday and I'm not doing it, wouldn't it be better if I knew that on Monday and I actually told you that? So that's a kind of healthy sort of feedback commitment management process. And, you know, you need to do that whether you're on an agile software development team or whether you're anybody doing OKRs. So we find we get a lot into that kind of space and, you know, are finding ways to measure those things like what you're talking about, because those really have a lot to do with engagement and happiness and those kinds of factors.
So one of the things I always find interesting with, like, the OKR space and key results is, you know, one of the things I've always tried to kind of teach people is that at some point, like, we may find out that this key result we're trying to achieve is completely unattainable. So how do you, like, I don't know if you address it in the book, or I'd like to get your thoughts on, like, how do you help people establish, like, baselines to abort? Like, when is it time to abandon that key result because you're starting to get data in that says, there's no way in heck we're ever going to make this.
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things. What I recommend is that, you know, every week when the team is having a meeting talking about what they're doing, and most teams meet at least that often, not only talk about the objectively measurable progress you're making on that, but talk about how confident are we that we're actually going to get there. So that involves a lot of gut feelings. So I would typically, you know, recommend people do like a fist of five. And like, if you're not at least a four, well, why? And it may turn out like, well, I don't think we're going to make it because actually I think this is a really bad idea. I don't think we actually know what we're doing. I don't think we're going to get there. That's not going to show up in your objective data until you get to the end and you haven't made it, right? So we do that. And we recommend a formal mid-quarter review where by then you ought to have some data, even if you can't get to it on a weekly basis, and say, okay, let's talk about that. So that's typically a spot. We'll do an intervention at the mid-quarter and an intervention at the end to say, okay, what's actually happened here? And there could be a lot of reasons for that. Whenever you're going into a goal-setting process, especially something longer than a week, you're making assumptions about what's possible, what's doable, what's important. And by the end of a quarter, all of that could have changed. Something could have emerged that's a new priority that just knocked you out. Or you might have thought you could create something that you're not actually able to. It's more complicated than you thought. So pivot.
I'm going to ask one question, and then while you're answering it, I'm going to have to jump out to get to the graduation. So I'm going to ask it and then let you guys run with it.
Should I edit that out?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm getting blown up by text messages that there's no seats left already.
Okay.
So switching gears a little, Dan, I'd love to hear about your experience here at Mile High Agile and what sessions you've attended. And are there things from any of those sessions that you're excited to take back into your work with your clients?
Yeah, there's been a whole lot of stuff. We're just at the beginning of the second day. I guess working my way back from the end of the day yesterday, which is easier to remember. I loved Peter McGraw's presentation on comedy. And so he wasn't teaching us how to do stand-up comedy, but more he was teaching us how to think like a comedian. And to me, the presentation was really, it was about branding. And I found that really fascinating. So I think that was an unusual presentation. I don't tend to go for the super technical presentations on, you know, DevOps or specific tools because I'm just not in that space. I'm looking for presentations on that affect how do leaders behave, how do we market what we're doing, and those kinds of things. So really enjoyed that. Went to two presentations yesterday on Kanban and WIP, one of them by you, Colleen, which was absolutely great, about why we need WIP limits. And then there was a great presentation on Kanban that was a longer one yesterday. So all of those are really good. I find Kanban in particular, anybody at any level can use that. I think it's just a great tool, making work visible.
Yeah, you know, between the making work visible and the making policies explicit, and, you know, you were kind of talking about that accountability and, you know, it's setting that rule of like, this is what done looks like, or this is how we get it to the next stage. I think those are all powerful kind of concepts that do, you know, tie into, you know, I've been teaching, I just wrapped up my talk on talking about business outcomes and how people need that. And they need to know why they're delivering those things. But it also helps start to drive some of that accountability in the organization because now you're focused on actually achieving something.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's really important to be able to present the ideas at the right level with the right vocabulary to leaders because I don't know about you, but I did have a period I was working, you know, purely doing agile coaching for a while. And what I found was the leadership was not agile. They didn't think they should be expected to do that. They thought of agile as a technique that those folks in the cubicles have to do. And so they would just come around and say, okay, we need these features. They didn't take the time themselves to understand agile. So I think you're going to get a more successful transformation if everybody understands it.
Absolutely. So one of the things I'm always curious about, and you know, I see a lot of organizations struggle with this. How do you teach or coach people on the cascading process? Because a VP is going to set these objectives and these key results, but how do we help cascade that down? Because from especially in big organizations where it's multi-tier business units and all these craziness, like you're trying to cascade something that's 10 levels up down to people in the field. Like how do you facilitate that? Do you do like a series of workshops? Like how do you kind of help cascade that down through the organization? Like I find that most companies kind of are terrible at this.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, yeah, and often what you get at the top level, especially if you have a very financially driven organization, you get these things like, well, we want our EBITDA to be better. We want our share price to be better. And if you're off working in the human resource department, let alone a technical team, you're like, I don't see where I have any impact on this. So I like to break that down. So if you look at something like earnings, you know, there's a great book that was written 30 years ago about theory of constraints. And the goal, yeah, that's it. And, you know, the great thing with that is the way that he defines, like there's those three factors. I'm remembering at least two of them right now. There's inventory, there's expenses, and there's like a throughput one, isn't there?
Yeah, I can't remember. I totally can't remember it though, but you're right with the other two. But yeah, just talking about the flow of materials and things like that in relation to inventory. And
so, yeah, if you think about, well, what do we really mean by inventory? It isn't just stuff sitting in the warehouse. you know, in one of these Kanban workshops yesterday, we were talking about the idea that, well, having code done and tested and not released is a form of inventory. And if you're not releasing it, you're actually adding to inventory. So I think if you help people understand how they can make those concepts sensible in their own department. The other thing that is really cool with OKRs that's been in there from the beginning is that everything doesn't have to cascade top down. Like, okay, if I'm three levels down in a department, I'm in the marketing department, and yeah, we have an EBITDA goal, key result, at the top level of the organization. Everything I do doesn't have to contribute to that. I can also look around and look at my relationships with other teams and say, where can we improve that? So that's, I call that getting a balance of top-down goals and bottom-up goals. And depending on what kind of team you are, that can vary. Like the engineering teams at Google typically look for 60 to 70% of their goals being bottom-up. And the reason for that is Google is in a very positive cash flow situation, and they want those engineers coming up with new ideas that are the products of tomorrow. If you're in sales, you're going to tend to be more top-down. But you can look around and say, well, who are our internal customers? How could we improve value for them? And where do we go from there? So you might even develop a shared OKR. So an example of that would be when they rolled out OKRs at Intuit, what they were doing was trying to move all of their products to the cloud. This is a few years ago now. So, you know, like TurboTax and QuickBooks and those things. And the leader of the whole technical group published OKRs and communicated them and encouraged people, like, talk to each other and come up with what you think needs to be done, even if it's not obvious that it directly contributes to this. What are things that get in your way? What are things that cause you stress, that reduce your happiness, create burnout, all of those kinds of things, whatever it might be? Or what ideas do you have that I'm not going to think about that at my executive level, but you know that it's important? And the result of that was, you know, different teams, like the UX team would go talk to the database team because they realized there was something about the way the data was showing up that was impacting UX. And they basically got onto the cloud in half the amount of time he would have anticipated if he'd just done a top-down type of project plan. So those are some ideas about how to do that.
It's interesting. You know, you're talking about top-down and bottom-up OKRs. I never really thought about it from the number, like goals and outcomes coming from the teams upward. That's interesting for me. And I'm definitely gonna have to pick up your book and read it now. But
all right.
How do you get the top people aligned with the stuff that's coming from the bottom up? Like, how do you create that space where it's a great idea. Like, the teams can control their destiny. It's within their ability to potentially influence, which in theory should help make more motivated teams. But now, how do you get management bought into these ground up kind of objectives?
Good question. Well, there needs to be some kind of an alignment process. And the way I've seen that work depends on the size of the organization. But say you've got, 16 teams in the organization. What I typically take people through is I work with the senior leadership to define the top level. And then often members of that team, they're responsible for other teams, right? So I work with them to take that out there, and then they draft team level OKRs. So it might be, the sales group comes up with its own, but then we bring everybody back together to make sure that those are in balance. So you don't have a situation where sales is selling way more than operations can deliver. So we make sure that things aren't in conflict. We're not setting people up for conflict. So sometimes that involves getting everybody back in a big room type of meeting, and everybody presents what they're doing, and we look for places where it's not balanced. Another typical problem is if you've got a lot of people saying, well, okay, we need to do that, and we're going to need an app for that. So it turns out that I had one situation where there were 16 teams, and 12 of them all needed something new from IT in order to do it. And IT was already too busy. They had too many products on their plate, projects. They were not prioritizing them well. They weren't getting any help from anybody else. And then this totally put them over the top. So we had to design a new prioritization process, and the CEO needed to come in and provide some arbitration around that. But you need to make the work visible, whether it's top down, bottom up, or sideways, so everybody understands what everybody's doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can, and it's, you know, it's difficult, I think, for large organizations to kind of, like, there are so many moving pieces. Like, you know, one of the things we've been working on this whole leadership thing, and David Marquet wrote Turn the Ship Around, and his intent-based leadership. And it's, you know, people need the technical competency and the clarity. So goals to really have the ability to be empowered. So, you know, that's why I see a lot of value in OKRs, is because now you have a set of goals, people have the right clarity, you can invest in them to maybe be able to make those decisions, and allow them to push those decision making down lower in the organization. So have you seen OKRs used to help, like, in those conversations of being able to push, like, decision making down further into the organization, like, instead of those 16 teams needing to go to IT to get that done, could have there been some way to find a way to empower the teams to kind of bring that in on their own to not make IT the bottleneck?
Well, this is where I think managing by results rather than, you know, here's the five things I want you to do really helps, because here's the results I'm after. You're empowered to determine what those might be. So one thing I find is we often need a conversation about what our decision-making rules are. So, and, you know, I got a lot from reading Don Reinertsen's work on that, like, you know, deferring decisions till the last possible moment. He talks a lot about when it makes sense to have a centralized decision and when it should be decentralized. And if it shouldn't be centralized, it defaults to decentralized. And, you know, yeah, you do get some personality types in management that find that a little difficult. So that's one of those cultural factors that we have to address. And I think it's moving away from management by process, which means we're going to define exactly what the process ought to be, to more of managing by commitment. So it comes back to what I was saying earlier about getting better at making and managing commitments, so that, for instance, that IT department, if they're very clear what their capacity is, they're forcing you to make a very clear definition of done when you make a request of them, and they are empowered to say no if they can't do it, or they can say when we can talk about it or when we can do it. Then you're going to have, you know, healthier balancing. So it's either like we have to put that off, or we need more resources. And that's management by commitment.
Excellent. Excellent. The management by commitment is an interesting, it's an interesting idea. So, you know, in your kind of, in the, I was looking through the table of contents of your book, and I'm definitely going to need to read it. But can you talk to me more about, like, the actual, like, how do you start to build that? Because it talks about, like, a strategy framework or strategy.
Right. Yeah. It's because I worked in strategic planning and strategy management for a long time. I wanted something that met the standards of that kind of industry. And so typically, and this is where I think it's very different from a feature factory approach or some of these other scaling frameworks, where the strategy just kind of descends onto the team. It kind of comes in from outside the model. And that's maybe fine at that level, but what we need to do is this, it needs to feed back up. So you need to integrate double loop learning through the whole thing. So this was a concept Chris Archer has talked about. He was an organizational theorist that taught at Harvard, just recently deceased. So rather than just saying, okay, we did this, did we get it done? Okay, move on to the next thing. You're stepping back and saying, did that actually make sense? Did that create value? So if OKRs are done properly, we're teaching everybody to do a better job of strategic thinking, which is double loop learning. So you're saying, like, okay, how are my assumptions and filters about the world affecting the possibilities that I see are open to me? And this is an idea that goes back to John Boyd's OODA loop. He was a fighter pilot and said, well, you know, to be successful as a fighter pilot, which means not getting killed, you need to rapidly be able to observe, to orient, which is to, like, check your filters and say, well, what am I seeing? Am I sure I'm seeing what I'm seeing? Make a decision and act. And you need to go through that loop faster than your opponent. And in the business, you're going through that OODA loop faster than your competitor.
I've never heard the OODA loop. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's great stuff. I mean, folks who've been in the military are really fond of that kind of model because, you know, in the military, even though military has a reputation justified for being extremely bureaucratic in peacetime, when you've actually got people in the field, there have been a lot of very agile ideas floating around there, whether they called them that or not, for a long time.
Yeah, it's so funny that how we can go back to the military and look at, like, how agile they have been or their ideas of, like, the concepts they've used. And now they're just all kind of starting to surface.
Right.
Like, over the last, I'd say, like, 4 or 5 years, like, military books have been coming out more and more. And I lost my train of thought. There was something I wanted to ask you.
Well, we had been on the subject about, like, the 5 steps. So it is a complete strategy process.
Yes.
Where, you know, you start off assessing. That's what I call it. Assess is the first step. So you're looking at, well, who are our stakeholders? How are they being affected by the big trends? How well are we performing in relationship to them? So we're kind of just getting a fix on what's our reality. And then the next step is saying, well, what do we want to do with that? Because then we need to make a choice about how are we playing the game? How are we defining the rules of the game and what is success for us? So you need to go through those 2 steps, which really involves then saying, well, you know, what's our mission? What are the big competitive themes that we've got going? And then we start setting OKRs. So that's really the 3rd step. We start making these commitments to results. And that devolves down into these quarterly types of OKRs. But then you actually have to be acting week to week. So action is the 4th step of it. And that's where I brought in a lot of agile techniques, you know, Kanban, regular retrospectives, a lot of those kinds of things. And then the 5th step is learning. That's where the double loop learning comes in, that we said, okay, how did that work? If that key result was not successful, even if it was successful, why was it successful or not successful? How does that challenge the assumptions that we're making about the reality? Like, you know, if we're used to thinking we're way ahead of our competitors, what evidence would actually tell us that maybe we're not? So if you look at the key results as really, you have hypotheses about what you're trying to do, and like a good scientist, you're looking at whether or not our hypotheses true. You know, what filament material is going to make this light bulb work, like the process Edison went through? What would make it not work? Well, if it blows up within 2 seconds, we know it doesn't work. So we know we need to keep looking. What are we trying to prove or disprove? So it's, in a way, it's a very scientific process that is leading us to a lot of mental agility, because I think I get concerned sometimes that agile in some cases becomes a methodology, and information technology is, you know, we're used to having methodologies, but if you just turn it into that and don't bring the mindset along with it, I think you're going to have limited success with it.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, a lot, everybody at the Uprising kind of preaches that. It is about a mindset. It's not about the process and practices. Like, that's one way to get there. to manifest it through like physical action, but you do eventually need to get to understand the context of why we're doing these things and why this practice is valuable in the relation to its principle and how that principle relates to the value, so that you understand that. And it's, you know, so there is the OKR cycle. How do you kind of just gone through the five steps of it. How do you look at that from like where a product's in a particular set of life cycle? Like, how would you like structure that conversation around OKRs for, you know, a product that's like nearing like end of, like it's not necessarily end of life, but it's time to like basically put it into maintenance mode and, you know, you're only adding stuff to keep it regulatory compliant. Like that kind of, like, how would you like kind of look at that as, cause you know, you have all these different converging life cycles of, like,
right.
We have to have goals for this thing, but it's also at that point in time where we need to kind of just like put it out to pasture and let it kind of eat grass.
Right, right. One thing you could do is you could take each product and have key results for each product. So if you've got an extremely mature one, any kind of mature product, you're basically just trying to maintain as much margin as possible on it. So you're making less investment into it, and you're really just trying to harvest cash as long as you can, because you need that cash in order to fund the new projects that aren't generating revenue yet. So I think you could just look at that classic marketing model and say, well, what do we want? Because at an early stage, a product, you want to measure buzz in some fashion. Are people talking about it on social media and magazines and places like that? Are we increasing revenue? Are we increasing market share? Once you get to the point you're over the hump, you know, you're just really, you're not going to invest a lot of marketing in it because you've already got users that are using it. Like a product in a subscription model, it's just you're going to try and hang on to as many customers paying X amount per month per user as long as you possibly can.
Awesome. That is definitely awesome. Well, Dan, we really want to thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure to kind of talk to you. So we're kind of at the point in the show where we'd like to give you some opportunities to kind of plug anything you got going on, events coming up. If you want to give a quick, like where people can get your book, or even get in touch with you.
Okay.
So if they'd like to continue the conversation.
Well, great. As far as the book, you can just go to startlessfinishmore.com. And that actually that's a landing page on my website that just shows you what you need to do. So the book, I only made the book available on Amazon so far. So you can buy the Kindle version really anywhere in the world and download it. It takes a little longer to get the physical book if you're outside of the United States, and that's on my list to work on. I need to make it more available, you know, particularly Canada, UK, and Australia. I've had a lot of interest, but it takes them a long time to get the book. But you can definitely get it instantly on Kindle. I'm on LinkedIn. You know, and beyond that, most of our business right now is pretty much face-to-face. We start with workshops and then follow up with coaching. We are looking at some online learning products, but expect those to come on stream later in the year.
So if people would like to book you for a workshop or get you to come in and kind of engage you on that, would they go to the same website with Start Less, Finish More?
Yeah, you can just, that's easier to remember. It's also agile-strategies.com. It basically will get you to the same set of pages, and you can contact me directly through there, and I will follow up usually in a day or two.
Awesome. Well, Dan, thank you for your time, and on behalf of the Agile Uprising, we thank you. And, you know, for everybody, you know, who's listening to this, if you could give us a like or review on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast hosting site, we'd appreciate that. And this is the Agile Uprising signing out.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.